because you can. Get out and see the world because you can. Get out and see the world because you can. There's a whole world waiting for you. What are you waiting for? Life can change, stats can turn, fate can take a twist. You still have the freedom to travel. Get out and see the world because you can.
Hi, this is Cindy Smith with the Freedom to Travel Internet Radio Show, coming to you every other Sunday at 3:55 p.m. Pacific Time or 6:55 p.m. Eastern Time. Today we're pre-recording our show, so if you're listening, you want any information on my guest, you can always come to my personal website at www.freedomtotravelshow.com. You can find any kind of information there. Or you can also write any comments you would like to on the BBS site. I'm the executive producer and host of a television series called The Freedom to Travel Show. I'm going to briefly explain what that is and how that relates to this radio program. The show or the series is where I highlight a guest that is disabled and we go to a travel destination that's completely accessible. So basically what I'm doing in each show is highlighting this amazing person, their achievements and their attitude around their disability, and educating my viewers on what their disability is while I'm providing a service to people with a disability. And this radio program is simply an extension of it in that we are traveling, but not in the literal sense. Instead, we're traveling to a deeper part of our hearts. We're enhancing our love, connection, and understanding of one another. We're taking a journey into a heightened awareness and a new perspective or outlook on issues of disabilities. Today, I'm proud to introduce a man that has personally touched me with his book that I happened to stumble upon at the bookstore. And what happened was that it caught my eye. There was a picture of a man, and that's Alan Rucker, sitting in a wheelchair at an outdoor party. And there's people dressed up around him. And he sits some feet below their headline. In fact, in the picture, their head's not even there. And his arms are open as if to say, here I am. Here I am, world. So it caught my eye, and some of you may have read it by now, and if not, I highly recommend it. It's called The Best Seat in the House, How I Woke Up One Tuesday and Was Paralyzed for Life. It was written by my guest today, Alan Rucker. He has a BA in English with two and holds two masters, one in communications and the other in American culture. He is the author or co-author of 9 books of humor and nonfiction. One of those, The Sopranos Family Cookbook, was a New York Times #1 bestseller. He currently has a book at #29 on the New York Times bestseller list called Redneck Woman, which is a memoir co-written with Gretchen Wilson, the country music star. Alan is a TV writer, producer, and co-founded the experimental video group TVTV and has written numerous network specials, documentaries, and teleplays, and not to mention received an abundance of various awards. He teaches at the U.S. School of Cinema TV, and he lives in L.A. with his wife, Anne Marie, and they have 2 sons. Without further ado, Alan, welcome to my show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
I didn't know where to begin.
That look on my face on the cover of the book, which you said, here I am, it's really, how did I get here?
You know, it's really interesting.
It's more, here I am, but also kind of, geez, this is strange.
Yeah.
And it is strange, as you know. Anyway.
Yeah, well, you know what? That's one thing. For the people, you know, I loved the book, actually.
Oh, I
wanted to tell you that because I am incomplete paraplegic. And like you, one day I was able-bodied and within a fleeting second, I was disabled for life.
Right.
And, you know, as you know, and as you've so eloquently written in your book about the emotional changes, but what I love so much about your book, Alan, is the way you present it. It hits deep because it's true and it's so poignant, but you do it with this style that allows the reader to actually take it in without fear. And
right.
I just love it. I just love it. You did a great job, and I can't believe it's not a number one bestseller yet.
Yeah, well, hang in there.
Yeah, no kidding. How is it doing?
Well, it's doing fine. It just came out in paperback a couple months ago, so it's doing fine, but, you know, it's hard to... I'm not a celebrity. If my last name was Michael J. Fox, I'd probably be doing better. But the reception is really the critical reception, and certainly the reception I've gotten from other people, other disabled people, has just been overwhelming. I've gotten hundreds, if not thousands, of emails, and I now go out. The book has kind of opened the door to me going out and speaking. I'll be speaking all summer at various places. The main place being this is a really mouthful. The Third International Neuroimmunologic Disorder Symposium, which is a really, really long way of saying a gathering of the smartest people in the world who know things about MS, transverse myelitis, which is what I have, lupus, and various other kind of neuroimmunologic disorders. In other words, really just immune system screw-ups, basically. But it's a really important group to me, and so I go out and I speak a lot, and people, what?
That was funny. Immune system screw-ups.
Yeah, that's all it is.
Yeah,
I'd like to give a bigger word for it. Anyway, but I love going out, and I've really gotten involved in disability kind of activities. I'm a co-chairman of the Writers with Disabilities Committee at the Writers Guild, and I'm very active in a lot of other forums now. Anyway.
I was really amazed. Yeah, good. Because you know what? Frankly, I think there's a shift or a movement right now within the public. And maybe it has something to do with the great number of people with disabilities or the newly injured people or, you know, there's just a huge population, obviously, of disabled people. So I think maybe... You know, being able to, what I like about your book is it really kind of touches on this sensitive subject, but it's so, I don't know, I just love everything about it. I felt myself, I was injured 26 years ago. So a lot of what you wrote, I have gone through and it's kind of beyond me now, you know,
right.
Behind me.
Oh,
I mean.
Absolutely.
And so reading your book was like, whew, it brought up all this fresh pain, if you will, but also a great sense of relief that I've come as far as I have.
Right.
And your book is a great way, and I, as you know, right after I wrote it, I contacted you, and I was like,
right.
Oh my God, I love it, Alan, you know, and
right,
I sent
right.
it on to the NSCIA, which is the National Spinal Cord Injury Association, because I think for newly injured people, it really helps to know there's someone out there that
right.
who's also gone through this loss.
Yeah.
So I just loved it. I think it's a great form
yeah.
of...
I think a lot of things, a lot of people, and I say this in the book, this occurred to me, you know, as I said, on a Tuesday afternoon, it occurred very, very suddenly, and it was not anything I expected or had ever prepared for or had any idea how to, you know, react to. And I think a lot of people, and I was in that, are very, very fearful that something like this is going to happen to them and they're going to turn into a basket case and crawl off into the corner of their room and never come out again. And the fact is people have a lot more emotional reserve, a lot more grit than they think they do. I at least found that in my own case. And as I looked around and started talking to people and watching people go through things like this, I realized that to be true, that we have a lot more reserve. People are very afraid sometimes of the future, of getting sick or getting injured or becoming paralyzed or something like that. And that fear gets in the way of them, first of all, enjoying their life, and secondly, no, it's good to know, and it took me a while to learn this, that you, there is life after paralysis. You can go on. You can live a full and rich life. And that's kind of the message of the book. But you know, it's a journey. You have to go through some shifts, some emotional shifts. I'll tell you this. The reason I think there are a lot of disabled people in America, 56 million. One out of every 5.5 people is listed as disabled. I don't know where these stats come from, but this is what I throw around, and it's commonly shared. And there are more people becoming disabled every day simply because the population is aging. The baby boomers, every 7 seconds, one of them turns 50. The occurrence of things like MS increase with age, as a lot of other disabling diseases. More people who you'll see more disabled people. And also, we're finally reaching a small shift in kind of consciousness about the disabled. No longer do we think of this just because someone's in a wheelchair that they're either mentally deficient or deaf. People always come up to me and start yelling in my ear like I'm deaf. But
I know
a long
it's
way
not
to go
funny.
Because public perceptions are changing, but it's very gradual, and there's still a kind of, you know what it is? It's more of a fear than it is of a discrimination. It's more of a kind of not quite sure whether I should be around these people. But for instance, the very first time I ever went out in a wheelchair, I went across the street from this big hospital in LA to a shopping mall, and almost immediately I experienced something that the people in wheelchairs anyway experience all the time, which is some little kid kind of is like staring at me. Because he's never seen anyone in a wheelchair, and he's like 5 years old. He wants to ask, "What happened to you? Why are you riding around in a chair?" And his mother will grab his arm and jerk it off to pull him away from you. And you're not sure if it's because the mother thinks the kid is being rude by staring, or that I have some contagious disease, or that I might be mentally weird and start babbling or drooling or something. Or what? But it's not rude for a kid to look at you. It's not rude for a kid to stare. It's rude for mom to stare, but it's not rude for the kid to stare. And I just realized that people have this we should just stay away from that person. And that happens on an unconscious level. It doesn't happen on a conscious level. No one in America, anyway, at least that I've found, will come up and say, I think you're kind of an inferior person because you're, paralyzed. No one would ever think that. Or I think you're scary to be around or anything. It's just a kind of unconscious uneasiness is what it is, self-conscious.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree with you. And, I think really, I don't know if you heard about this, but recently I read I think it was on the internet actually, about a football player who decided he was going to take a 30-day, he was going to live in a wheelchair for 30 days and act as though his legs were paralyzed. So he would literally have to transfer onto the bathroom. Yeah, I forgot who it was, but I just thought that was such a neat thing to do because that was another thing. When I filmed my pilot, one of my cameramen, we were at Mohegan Sun, which is a pretty big casino. And I was up doing something because I can walk, but I like to use my chair for freedom purposes. Anyways, he said, "Do you mind if I sit in that? I want to use that chair." I think he wanted to just try out the wheelchair. And he got in and he pushed down a little ways and he turned back and he said, "You know what?" And he wasn't gone for 3 minutes. He came back. He said, "I can't believe the way people acted towards me. I cannot believe it. I never understood." Mm-hmm. And I think it's true. I'm with you. The child is innocent, but I think that we as a whole, the community kind of instill this preconceived belief because for lack of knowing any better, it's just ignorance on the community's part. I don't think people are, you're right. I don't think they're intentionally hurtful or grossed out or whatever. I just think that most people don't know how to be.
Yeah.
Well,
I make an analogy that my wife thinks is out of date, but I grew up in Oklahoma in the 50s, and there were these things called the Rotary Meeting, these all men's, like Wednesday lunches, the Rotary Club, the Kiwanis Club, the Elks Club, etc. And the analogy is I often feel like the only black guy at an all-white Kiwanis Club meeting.
You're right.
Well, I've been invited to join the club, right? And they want me to be part of the paper drive and, you know, and you know, be involved in all the activities. But some people there are nervous that I'm there. They're just nervous around black people because they've never been around black people. Most of them go out of their way to try to tell you how normal they think you are, which, of course, makes you feel abnormal because they're paying way too much attention and talking about things that they think you want to talk about. Like if you're a black guy, they think you want to talk about football or Mike Tyson or something, and you may want to talk about stamp collecting. It's just that kind of level of discomfort and so self-consciousness that people feel. And it's really the person, the disabled person or the person in the wheelchair, it's kind of their job, or at least partially their job, to help break that down with humor or however else you'd want to do it. Answering questions, talking directly, not talking about it. Sometimes not talking about it is the best thing to do, just to, you know, bull ahead. I was teaching my very first class I taught at the UFC Film School in a wheelchair. I walked in and I was sure there was a class about modern documentaries, and I'm sure that everybody in the room, all the kids, were like staring at the wheelchair wondering what happened. So I went into this lengthy explanation until about halfway through I realized that all their eyes were glazed over because they really weren't interested in hearing about my problems. They were interested in knowing what they had to do to get a good grade. Did they have to speak up? What if they missed class? They were only interested in what the course was about. They weren't really interested in me. And sometimes people are only interested in, you know, what's in front of them and not necessarily interested in you and your problems. So I try not to bring it up, you know. Those college kids couldn't have cared less. They wanted to know if they had to write a term paper, you know.
Yeah, right. Wait a minute. No, whatever. How much work do I have to do?
Exactly.
Hey, one of the ongoing themes with many of my guests has been this subject, like what we're on talking about as far as disabilities and what it's like being the disabled person. And you know, do you ever get on a subject and you completely forget what you're trying to say? Because I want to also, I do it all the time. Yes, okay. I was going to bring something out, but it's unimportant. What I really want to get down to is if somebody out there hasn't read your book, do you mind telling us a bit about what actually happened to you? Because like,
please. If it ties with someone to read it. Are you listening? No, what happened to me was that I was, I'm a writer in Hollywood, long-term kind of journeyman writer in Hollywood, written a lot of comedy shows, documentaries, and specials, et cetera. And I was just tooling along in my life in December of 1996, and I was actually unemployed at the time, which is not an uncommon experience. And I was laying in bed on a Tuesday afternoon reading a magazine, kind of nursing what I thought was a sore throat, but which had nothing to do with what was about to occur. And I felt this incredible pain around my midsection. It felt like someone took a branding iron and branded me. It was really the most excruciating sharp pain I think I've ever felt. And it kind of came and went within like a two-minute period, and I went, boy, that was strange. And my wife and I decided it was some kind of weird flu that had gotten in my back. She took off for the dentist, and in the next 90 minutes, I got progressively weaker and weaker and weaker till I got out of bed at one point and just fell on the floor, and I realized this wasn't the flu. And it was a totally frightening, unexpected experience. And it was then diagnosed by a smart doctor who finally showed up at the emergency room as a disorder, a neurological and immune disorder called transverse myelitis. Transverse myelitis is like MS of the spine, as one guy described it. MS is a disease that destroys the myelin tissue and kind of happens off and on all over your body, called multifocal. And TM, or transverse myelitis, only occurs in one place, and usually only occurs at one time. And it is your immune system kind of attacking what it thinks is a virus or some kind of foreign protein in your spine, and it goes into overdrive and causes a huge inflammation. And the inflammation is what causes the damage. So basically, it's your immune system that damages you, but thinking that it's doing a good deed. So I'm paralyzed a lot of people with transverse myelitis, after the inflammation goes down, the damage is not that great. They can walk. I've seen people completely recover. I think most people recover only in part. In my case, I didn't recover at all. The damage was severe and over like a two vertebrae space. So from the waist down, I'm basically totally paralyzed. Completely paralyzed, as complete as you can get, I guess.
So
I had to start over. You know, I was 51.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a wife and two kids and a job and a mortgage the size of Montana. And
yeah.
I had to get on with my life and kind of in some ways, just kind of finished what I started out to do, and other ways, kind of, you know, redefine myself, reinvent myself. But I don't go ahead.
You were 51 when you got it.
Yeah.
And there's obviously other people with TM. Do you know how many people in the United
States?
Yes,
I do. I'm very active in the TMA, the Transverse Myelitis Association. They're about 30, they don't really know for sure, but there's somewhere between 35 and 40,000 people in America that have TM. It's very rare, as opposed to, let's say, between 400 and 500,000 people that have MS. But it's a rare disorder, guys at Johns Hopkins are trying to figure out why it occurs and, you know, how best to kind of treat it, and they're just beginning with their research. But no one, in my case, they often see it associated with another disease like MS or lupus or some other disorder, some other immune disorder. It's kind of part and parcel to that. And other cases like mine, it has no other dimension to it, and they don't really know why it occurred. If it was in fact a foreign cell, a toxic cell in your system, your immune system would have destroyed it before any doctor could examine what it was. It's already gone. So it's kind of like the evidence gets burned up, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it could be, in some cases, they think it might just be an immune disorder. Immune system misidentifies something as a foreign agent and attacks it. So there's a lot of mystery about it, but
so you can't necessarily. There are no signs that you know. It could be random. There's nobody has like pinpointed what kind of signs may show up.
There are no signs that I know of. There's no
no way to prevent it from happening.
There's no announcement. Yeah, no.
Right.
You can eat all the vitamins you want. I don't think it'll make any difference.
You can't prevent it, and you can't test for it.
No, you cannot.
It doesn't exist.
Listen, no.
Mm-hmm.
Please, I'm not a doctor. I just play one on television. No, there really isn't. I mean, it comes on. It often comes on very, very quickly. Like in my case, it was within an hour and a half. I went from, you know, full bodied to crippled for life or paralyzed for life. In other cases, it comes on a little slower, but they don't really have the means to stop the progression of it in the same way. They can slow down the progression of MS now. You can see it in certain people with certain drugs, but not TM. But you've got to remember, it's such a small universe of people that there's really only one place that I know of that's doing full-time research in the area, and that's at Johns Hopkins. There's a place called Project Restore, which is a kind of combined center for both TM research and MS research, and they're doing a lot of work. That's that event that I mentioned with the 12 words in it, is where I'm giving the keynote address, is really a gathering of the people who know most about this. So if any of your listeners have any kind of neurologic disorder that might fit them, they can go to the Transverse Myelitis website, which is myelitis.org.
Can you spell that for us?
Myelitis, myelitis.org.
Okay.
And find out more about this symposium, because it's like any kind of disorder like this they will address.
Okay.
There's a whole series.
And you're the keynote speaker, huh?
I'm the keynote speaker. I'm the guy that kind of, you know, welcomes people to the thing, and the only one with not a medical degree, so I don't really have to be smart. Just
I saw you on the Montel Williams show.
Oh,
I was very,
you.
Very impressed.
Okay.
So this do you ever see how this may have, this TMA could have, or it's just called TM, right?
Right.
Has kind of catapulted your career for you?
It's changed it. Sure, you know.
Yeah. How has it changed it?
Well, first of all, I was lucky because in a couple of ways, one in which I was already a writer, and and writing this book, among other books that I began to write after I became paralyzed, it helped me focus my writing, helped me to become a better writer, that and just kind of extended, you know, into other areas, whether it's being on television or speaking at, you know, at conferences and stuff like that. So yeah, if you got a lemon, make lemonade, you know.
Yeah, you say that in the book, don't you?
Yeah, something like that. Oh, by the way, I hope you have listeners in Southern California, I hope.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Can I plug something?
Please do. Because
it involves the National Spinal Cord Injury Association.
Yep. This weekend
in Anaheim, California, there's a big thing called the Abilities Expo. They have two or three of them a year around the country, and to me it's like a big trade show for the disabled, everything you'd want from services to, I guess, you know, vans or whatever, just all the technology as well as all the services kind of gather in a big fair, and it's this weekend, I'll be appearing there in Anaheim on May 31st at the National Spinal Cord Injury Association booth, signing books. So if you like what you hear and you're in the area, come by and, you know, buy a book.
I'm so glad you connected up with them.
Or don't buy a book. Just, you know, look through it and leave it on the table.
Buy a book, people. Worth it.
Buy a damn book, yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the whole group of NSCIA are amazing. It's an amazing group. And
right.
Maybe they also do this, it's called the Gala, Hall of Fame Gala, where they bring in amazing people from around the world who've really made an impression on the disability community, especially around issues of spinal cord injuries or diseases.
That's what I got. How do you get into the Hall of Fame? Someone has to nominate you?
Yep. That's right. And there's 12 or 13 categories. And you can go on there. It's on their website.
Is one of them writer of books?
You know what? If it is, I'm nominating you.
Oh,
actually, you know, that's one of the things I wanted to tell you. I was just, because I read your book quite a while ago now, and it's and since then I bought about 12 copies and handed them out to a bunch of my friends because I am directly involved with the NSCIA.
In what way?
I'm on the communications committee with the national board, but I also was very involved with the Connecticut chapter here and did a lot of work for many years. And in fact, I'm the person who gave them your information.
Well,
I got a hold of them and said, yes, I said, you've got to have this book in your bookstore because they were one of the things they were doing.
Thank you so much.
Oh, are you kidding? It's my pleasure.
I don't know them that well. I mean, they did a piece on me in the last magazine. I don't know if you saw
that.
Yeah, Fantuna. Newsletter. And they did a really great job, and then they asked me to do this. So I'm actually meeting them for the first time this weekend, face-to-face.
Oh, you'll love them. I used Fantuna. Santina's the girl I used in my pilot for my show. Because she kind of defies, you know, one of the things I wanted to do was, you know, taking my pilot into Hollywood. You know, obviously I think, and I was going to ask you that about your book, have you noticed, because the topic is about being disabled, that some people are a little reluctant?
Reluctant in what way?
Reluctant to pick it up or look at it.
No one's called me up to say they want to make a movie out of it, if that's what you mean. I don't know about it. Go ahead. Reluctant in what way?
Well, you know, I think one of the reasons why I haven't actually gone to a large network in Hollywood or wherever with my ideas because I'm afraid that they'll just take one look at it and say it's you know, a show about people with disabilities for people with disabilities, and that in itself will be enough for them. And they'll just say nope and set it aside, and it won't even be looked at, because the whole issue around disabilities is such a difficult one for a lot of people to deal with.
Yeah,
and so,
it's worth, you know, throwing it out there.
Sure it is.
I know a lot about this stuff because of my Writers Guild work. There were two pilots made last year, one for Fox, one for NBC. There were both of them, or I know at least one of them was a British spinoff with total disabled casts, and about, you know, disability was just kind of a side issue, but nevertheless, they were all disabled characters, and they both made it to pilot stage. They didn't make it on the air, but there could be 1,000 reasons for that. I haven't seen the pilots. Maybe they weren't funny, or maybe they, because networks buy shows that fit their schedules and fit their audience, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So, mm-hmm. but the fact is that they got made, and that in itself shows some sign of open-mindedness anyway.
Yeah, I think there's also a new, like the Extreme Makeover project.
Your project would be much better suited for cable television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Network television is too narrow. They're trying to go, you know, cable. Most interesting television is now made on cable, if you look at it.
Yeah.
The other day, there was a guy from TNT. He said, "All right, I'll give you. Tell me on whose schedule are Men in Leotards, and what was the other thing? That was really silly. I can't remember it now. As opposed to a show with an Academy Award winning actress. And the Men in Leotards was NBC, and the Gladiator show, and the Academy Award winning actress was TNT, and the show called Saving Grace with Holly Hunter.
Uh-huh.
Much more interesting place now.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. They're playing things with substance rather than some of these shows you turn on and it's like, are you kidding me? People watch this? But I think they're also targeting, you know, the teenage population, which in itself kind of upsets me because, you know, pop culture is such a... There's shows
for old people.
Yeah.
Cable shows, listen, it's just a business, you know, and you just figure out how you find your entry point into the business. I think there will come a time when, you know, because there's so many disabled people out there, that it'll be chic to be doing disabled programming or programming about the disabled one way or another, either fiction or nonfiction, because they know there's a huge market. I mean, there'll be thousands of people at the Abilities thing this weekend, you know, and it's because it's a market.
Huge. And exactly, and all these larger corporations are really starting to say, hey, wait a minute, what's our future? And you're right, you hit the nail on the head with the baby boomers and the newly injured and the, you know, the aging population, all that stuff. I mean, you said the 1 in 5 people. Well, I know where you got your statistics, and that was from the U.S. Census Bureau in the year 2000.
Yeah.
Now, we're talking yet many years later, so that's, you know, it has increased exponentially, you know, since then. So who knows? Maybe we're talking 2 in 5 now.
Well, that's enough for me.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, you know what? I wanted to ask you about the opening in your book, The Best Seat in the House, How I Woke Up One Tuesday, I Was Paralyzed for Life. You have a little excerpt in here from Elizabeth Bishop from One Art. I wanted to ask your opinion on this because I've contemplated this now, and I would really like to get your opinion on what this means. And I'm just going to read it for our listeners.
Oh, no.
The Art of Losing.
Poetry analysis now? Okay.
You don't have to. I just find it very interesting. Okay. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster.
Well, first of all, are you through?
Yes.
It's so beautifully written. Obviously, there's an irony in the whole poem, which is the art of losing is an art that's hard to master, but it is masterable. You can learn to lose and go on. You can get over loss. That's what the poem is about. And if you read the whole poem, you'll see in the end, it's really about the loss of a lover, and not about the loss of her keys. She goes on saying, you know, lose something today, lose your keys, lose your mind. But the irony is that there's a certain optimism in the poem that the art of losing isn't hard to master, because we all know that it is hard to master. That's what gives the poem its poignancy.
It's really
powerful.
Intense. Yeah, beautiful. I sat here thinking over it for a few hours.
Yeah,
and the other thing,
beautiful poet.
Yes, she is. The other thing I want to say is I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to go through here and pull out some things that I think are just so amazingly written. And I'm not exaggerating when I say I had so many things that I went over and read and was touched by.
Oh,
I couldn't,
simply could not pick.
Yeah, it's just so well done, Alan. It's so well done. You touch the heart of anybody. I say this is not just for people newly injured or injured. It's for anybody. This, if you ever wondered what it's like.
Anyone who's been injured or will be injured. Everybody.
Yeah, eventually, yeah.
You know,
so you said,
it does fall into a kind of a school of writing, I guess you'd call it, which is, you know, life after traumatic event writing or whatever. Hopefully I transcended the form by simply, you know, making it more honest than most of that stuff and, you know, more sarcastic.
it's really the attitude
I had toward life anyway, and it's just the kind of comic attitude that you develop if you do what I do for a living, and it just I applied it to myself, you know. So
well, you've written a ton of books here.
Yeah,
you know, I was looking through some of these, and wow, Hometown Boy Makes Good, starring Anthony Edwards. Oh, this is the movie.
That was a movie for HBO.
You've done The History of White People in America.
Yeah,
I didn't realize that was a series.
Well, it was a... Ooh, here's an email from you. Oh, just waiting myself.
Did you just get that?
History of White People in America was began as a cable series of just individual... It began like as a mock documentary about the white American and what happened to them. Then it turned into a kind of a series of shows. It ended up being 6 half-hour shows. And then a 2-hour movie called Scenes from a White Marriage. And then 2 books. And a lot of people know the title through the books and some know it through the TV show. But anyway,
and you are...
Martin Mull. I worked with this wonderful actor, comedian, your audience may or may not know, named Martin Mull for many years. And
yeah, I was noticing.
Extremely funny fellow and honored.
Do you sit around and just make each other crack up all the time?
We did then. I haven't seen him in a while.
Right.
You know, you go on to other things. I'm now working on.
Yeah.
I just finished a book, another book. I tend to, both before and after I wrote my own memoir, I've been asked to help other people write their memoirs, so I've become a what is known as a collaborator in the business, which sounds like something sinister, doesn't it? Like a spy, a collaborator. but I'm a collaborator.
That's exciting.
And I just collaborated with a very well-known country musician, you have to know the music, I guess, named Randy Owen, who's the lead singer of a group called Alabama that sold 70 million records. And Randy's a wonderful guy, and I just helped. We just finished, just this week, last week, finished his memoir that comes out in October.
So how long does a memoir take you? I mean, I cannot believe you've done so many things.
Well, it takes a while, you know. It, Randy and I began this, almost a year and a half ago. But part of that had to do with setting it up with the right publisher. But it takes a while. It varies.
So they come to you, they tell you their story, and you kind of write it up for them? Is that how it works?
That's kind of how it works. Sometimes I go to them so I can see where they live and talk to their mom and their kids and their dog and their best friend. And But it all, that basically what it is. It's I tell these stories in their voice, which is great because it's gives it a certain level of frankness and honesty.
Nice.
Kind of arm's length biography would.
You mentioned that your writing has kind of changed in that you have better focus and better writing skills since your injury.
Well, what happens is, what happened after I became paralyzed, not knowing what to do, it was a natural thing to just, first of all, to begin writing what was going on with me. It was like, you know, taking notes on your own life, which was an obvious thing for me to do. It helped me kind of, get my arms around the whole thing. It was also a natural thing for me to write to friends and start developing these long email correspondences about what I was dealing with. And it was natural for me to just go back to what I did professionally, which is write, but write in a different way, which I no longer really wanted to go to. At Hollywood, a lot of what is known as writing is really schmoozing or pitching ideas or going to lunch or collaborating with, you know, a whole bunch of people, et cetera. And all of those kinds of that was more difficult for me to do in a wheelchair. It wasn't impossible to do. It was just a little more difficult. And I realized I didn't really want to do those things. I never liked to do them in the first place. What I really like to do is write. And a wheelchair kind of puts you in front of the computer, and there you are. And the more you concentrate, the better you write. So I began to write more, fewer television shows, really, or certainly fewer kind of group writing situations, and more books. So I wrote 3 books on The Sopranos, all of which were kind of spinoffs from the show, working with David Chase, the creator, who's an old friend. I wrote a memoir with Tom Green, the comedian, called Hollywood Causes Cancer, because he came to Hollywood and immediately got cancer.
I didn't know that.
So we blamed it on Hollywood. and then I wrote my own book, and I write a lot of stuff for the disability press, I guess you'd call it, Ability Magazine. I write in every issue. I have a piece coming out in New Mobility, a wonderful magazine, coming out in June, coming out right now. I should have a copy in my hand, but I don't yet. I was invited to Walter Reed Army Medical Center to spend a day and hand out books with soldiers and talk to soldiers and stuff, and it's about that experience. And so in that sense, you know, it's being disabled has given me ability to focus on writing, focus on kind of prose writing, creative nonfiction. And it's also opened doors like Walter Reed that I would never have probably, gone through
right.
that door if I'd been in a wheelchair. Of course, it made me understand the situation a lot better. It's weird for people who aren't disabled to walk into a room that looks like a waiting room in your dentist's office, but have 25 men and women, all of whom are missing a limb, missing an arm, a leg, both arms and a leg, one leg, and their brain is shattered. I mean, it's much easier for me to do that because I have some cognizance of their experience than it is for just a regular, you know, able body ambulatory.
Exactly. Yeah, and also, and I'm sure you'll agree with this, in the same token, you're gaining from the experience of them.
No, I'm gaining more than that.
They're gaining from you, yeah.
I never knew what was in it for them, but people there waylaid my doubts. They said they really like to meet people like me who, you know, kind of have gone on in life, and it's valuable to them. I thought, well, thank God, I hope so.
Absolutely.
Fairly valuable to me, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed in your experience, your injuries, 1996 you said, right?
Yeah, about 1996.
12 years. Yeah, have you, well, because mine's been 26 years, I look back, I can see it differently now. You know, like for the first 5 years, I was kind of in denial. And it kind of, you know, that I was disabled, that I wasn't really, quote, disabled. You know, I was not a part of that crowd. That was about the first 5 years.
Who wants
of
to
the
be
struggle.
A part of that crowd?
Oh, not me. I'm still not. I'm kidding. And
I like disabled people. I guess I'm probably as scared of them as people are scared of me at first.
Mm-hmm. They just
don't know.
I
never could figure it out, but that was my guess.
Well, and then between like 5 and 10, you start, then the reality that, oh my gosh, I'm going to be like this forever. And then you have to come, like you've said a lot in your book, you make lemonade out of lemons, or your life is sour, and you make a decision. And
right.
I think at 10 years is really an interesting time in your life. So can you identify with that, kind of like looking back now after 12 years, the different stages of person goes through?
Writing that book was a way of, it's certainly a way of me to process those early years and the kinds of changes I went through. And I don't really go back now to ponder that, except when people bring it up. You know, I do talk a lot about I'm asked to talk a lot about the kind of social consequences of being in a wheelchair, what it's like out in the world, how people treat you, you know, really the small little social cues that are so important to how you're seen and how you see yourself and how you define yourself. That's, for instance, that's what I talked about on the Montel Williams show. So I'm asked a lot about that because basically I want to make the world comfortable for the disabled, not just for myself, but for anyone. And part of that is, as I say, it's a kind of dance. It has to do with both how a person perceives someone who's disabled and how the disabled person perceives themselves and projects themselves and makes the world comfortable for them to be around. So I do a lot of that, but I don't think this kind of sense of, there's a sadness involved in this shit, in this stuff. And it never goes away. It just recurs, and you handle it. You know, it's like every 6 weeks I wake up going, "What in the heck happened to me, Jesus?" So there's it's not Pollyannish. I'm not saying that this made my life better. It certainly made my life different in some category. In some ways, it made my life better. In other ways, it's made my life, less better.
Which is one of my questions here.
I can't run marathons anymore.
Right.
But I can't throw a
football. How has it made your life? Right.
Has it made my life better?
Yes.
Better or not better?
Well,
better?
I'd like your opinion on both, really. Yeah, but how about better?
Better, I got over a lot of fears. Something like this happens, you have to confront fears that you've always had about yourself. And you either cave into those fears or you tend to work through them. I go into the book a lot about how many people feel helpless in their lives. They feel like, oh, I can't get ahead, I can't do this, I've been tied down to this horrible job, etc. I'm a failure, whatever. They walk around with this kind of sense of helplessness. When you become actually physically helpless, you see the difference between being a victim and feeling victimized. When you're absolutely physically helpless and you have to work your way back from real helplessness, somehow this may click something in your mind, did in my mind, and overcoming the other sense of helplessness that you have about other aspects of your life. So in that sense, it can be very, very valuable. I will give you quickly a statistic about the disabled, which came from, and I use this in all my lectures, so if someone comes to one of my lectures, they have to act like they didn't hear this, because it's so powerful. It's very powerful. A doctor at Johns Hopkins turned me on to this. There was a study done called the Mohr Study, M-O-H-R, at the University of California Medical School in San Francisco, where these guys trying to figure out exactly how disabled people feel about themselves hit upon a very simple and direct way of doing it. They gathered the names, and I guess they had a way of doing this, of everyone or a huge population of people who had MS in the San Francisco area, and they picked up the phone and they called them and said, "Hey, how you doing?" So that they asked them directly how they were doing. And then they broke this up statistically, and they found that 20 to 30% of them had terrible adjustment problems, I guess you'd call it. They'd had problems with their spouses, they'd had emotional problems, they had problems at work, et cetera, which is not surprising because depression is very, very common among people with just newly disabled people and could have an organic basis, not just a psychological basis, but that's another subject. So that wasn't surprising. What was shocking to them and what was the reason that this study became famous is because a full 60% of the respondents, these are all people with MS, said that MS had in fact enriched their lives, had made them more tolerant of other people, more sensitive to the needs of other people, certainly more tolerant and sensitive toward the disabled. And not only that, had also given them a renewed ambition to accomplish something in their life. In other words, it hadn't destroyed their ambition. It hadn't defeated them. It had the absolute opposite effect, which is that, hey, if I can handle this MS, I can get some other things done in my life, too. And that's a powerful message. And I think that's often the case that happens to disabled people. There are obviously a whole bunch of people that are defeated by it, and I would never pass judgment on them because it's an awful thing. And everybody reacts in their own way. But there are also a lot of people, and that study underscores this, that really are kind of inspired by their own malady, inspired by their own impairment. And that's a strong message. And that's probably, you know, in a nutshell, what can happen to you and what's happened to me in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it shows in this book. I haven't had the opportunity. I haven't read any of your other books, but boy, I will look forward to all of them. Right now, your current project, you just finished one. Do you have anything else in the makings?
I got two or three. My next book is completely different. There's a rock star named Scott Whelan, who is the lead singer of a group called the Stone Temple Pilots. And known as much for his drug addiction as for his music, although he's a very talented musician. And I'm writing a book with his wife, also a former drug addict, about how to survive that kind of life. So that's a long way away from these clean-cut country people. Anyway,
how long do you... So you estimate that ought to take you about a year and a half to complete?
No, it wouldn't take that long. I don't know. I've already done a lot of work on it. We've already started on it before we actually sold it. But I do a lot of this journalism, and your audience, I would ask that people, you know, look for my name in those great magazines I mentioned, Ability and New Mobility, because that's where I'm doing a lot of stuff that connects with, you know, with disability.
The disabled community. The other thing I wanted to mention is that we are pre-recording, so this show isn't going to be until after the Abilities Expo in California.
I figured that.
Unfortunately. But there are other expos. I think that the website is actually www.abilitiesexpo.com or .org, something like that, where you can get other information to go to these, because they really are a remarkable way to connect with other people. And I think too, looking back, you know how the thing that these guys just did with all the people with MS, this is a survey, sorry. Whew.
Yeah.
Now, where was that? This survey is really amazing.
Research study.
A research, thank you.
Right.
I better write that down before I forget. The research study, I think, you know, we're talking about people with MS, which may slightly differ from the population that is automatically newly injured, because MS is a slower, isn't it, progressive neurological disease.
But there's a point where you know, it's been diagnosed and you realize that you have this thing to live with. It's not, you know, every experience is different, but there is a common
denominator.
Right.
Yeah, that's a very enlightening study, actually. I often wondered about that, how that works out. So the other personal question I wanted to ask you is...
Okay. My ears start to hurt. Yeah, go on.
How does your wife and your children, how have they done?
Well, I spent a chapter in the book talking about that. And actually with the kids, we thought it was going to, you know, some way affect them, especially the young 8-year-old boy who was 8 at the time anyway, who kind of discovered me in this condition, and we thought this was going to scar him mind and he was going to act out in some weird way years later, and it never occurred, never happened, because he, at 8 years old, he saw it as, when we said, well, that, you know, chances are dad will get better, because that's what the doctors thought at the time, he went, oh, that's good enough for me, and he went back to his life. So in some ways it went right over his head, because I never stopped working and, you know, I never left the house. I was in the hospital for a long time. But anyway, the other kid was off at college, so he was distant from it. I'm sure it's made them more sensitive in ways, in many ways, toward disabled people. And with my wife, we went through a pretty terrible 2-year period of struggle, emotional struggle and guilt and shame and, you know, wondering what the hell's going to happen now. And so that was tough. That was very tough. But and that's kind of pretty directly outlined in the book.
Yeah.
Fun and games. I'm not telling you, you know, this is not a TV movie. This is my life. You know, it doesn't happen like, you know, you don't just feel sad for a day and then wake up and say, by golly, I'm going to go on with life. Doesn't happen that way. It only happens that way in movies.
I happen to find you extremely inspirational, and I love the motivation you have and the message you're bringing on to our public, and I'm just, I say go for it, brother. I'm behind you all the way. I mean, I love how you write, and I'm going to, yeah, so I hate to cut you off, but we are running out of time, and I just want to also be able to inform my listeners a little bit about how they can contact you.
Go to allenrucker.com.
Okay.
allenrucker.com. That's my website. As you know, there's a, you know, you can contact me via email there. That's what most people do, and you can find out about what I'm up to and books and speeches and stuff like that. I try to keep it up to date. It's not easy.
That's the
starting point. And you can get the book anywhere. You can go on Amazon, or you can try your local bookstores, or Amazon.
Yeah, there.
Amazon's actually the best way to do it, because they, you get the book. That's the cheapest price, you know.
Discount, So that's great. And also, our listeners can go to my site. I will have your archive show on there.
Oh, great.
I'm really looking forward to having that on there. But it won't, well, hopefully we'll have it on before the June deadline. We'll see about that. But my Freedom to Travel show will have some information on there too. So just real quick, I'd just like to thank you, Alan, for this hour.
Welcome.
I really appreciate it. And, I hope one of these days you and I will run into each other at one of these abilities expos. So thank you again.
Well,
and
I hope
I'm just going
to. If it goes well this weekend, maybe, the spinal cord people will invite me to another expo. They're very involved in these things, I guess.
Oh, sure. And this is their 60th anniversary.
I know. That was the, they're being honored here in some way. I don't know how. I'll tell you after that, though. Well, listen, great to talk to you, Dahl. And,
thank you so much,
Alan. Keep in touch,
Alan.
And if I can be of any help to anyone, tell them to write me on the website, or if they just want to ask me a question. I'm fairly decent about returning.
Yes, you are. You got right back to me every single time I knocked on that door.
Okay,
so,
great.
Anyways, thank you so much. And just real quick, one more time, I'd like to tell my listeners, mark your calendars. You're not going to want to miss our next show. I have a guest named Yolaine Stout, and she is going to express her life story to us, also give us some insights on how to overcome depression, one of the things that Alan and I kind of quickly, briefly mentioned as a common denominator with newly injured or any kind of disability. I'm going to close up. I'm going to send many blessings of love to all of you. Don't forget, get out and see the world, because you can. There's a whole world waiting for you. What are you waiting for?
Because you can. Get out and see the world, because you can. freedom to try.